He had to find the others. He stumbled to his feet. Before he left the room, he turned and again shone the flashlight on his bed and stared transfixed by the single slab of concrete that had flattened the bed where he had lain only hours before. Khalil crossed the small courtyard and pushed on the splintered door of his sister's room. The door had come unfastened from its hinges and fell inward. His sisters, Adara, age 9, and Lena, age 11, shared a double bed. Adara was a happy child, and Khalil favored her, acting as more her father than her older brother. Lena was serious and studious, a joy to her teachers. Khalil could not bring himself to shine his light on the bed or even to look at it. He stood with his eyes closed, prayed, then opened his eyes and put the beam of light on the double bed. He let out a gasp. The bed was overturned, and the entire room looked like it had been shaken by a giant. Khalil saw now that the rear outside wall had been blown in, and he could smell the powerful, acrid stench of explosives. The bomb had detonated not far from here, he knew, and some of the explosion had blown down the wall and filled the room with fire and smoke. Everything was charred, tossed about, and reduced to unrecognizable pieces. He stepped over the rubble near the door, took a few paces, then stopped, frozen, one leg in front of the other. At the end of the flashlight's beam was a severed head, the face blackened and charred, the hair nearly all singed off. Khalil couldn't tell if it was Lena or Adara. He turned and ran toward the door, tripped, fell, scrambled across the rubble on all fours, and felt his hand coming into contact with bone and flesh. He found himself lying in the small courtyard, curled into a ball, unwilling and unable to move. In the distance, he could hear sirens, vehicles, people shouting, and closer by, women wailing. Khalil knew there would be many funerals in the next few days, many graves to be dug, prayers to be said, and survivors to be comforted. He lay there, numb with grief at the loss of his two brothers and two sisters. Finally, he tried to stand, but succeeded only in crawling toward the door of his mother's room. The door, he realized, was gone, blown away without a trace. Khalil got to his feet and entered the room. The floor was relatively free of debris, and he saw that the roof had held, though everything in the room looked as if it had been moved toward the far wall, including the bed. Khalil saw that the curtains and shutters had been blown out of the two narrow slit windows, and he realized that the force of the explosion outside had entered these windows and filled the room with a violent blast. He hurried to his mother's bed, which had been pushed against the wall. He saw her lying there, her blanket and pillow gone, and her nightdress and sheets covered with gray dust. At first, he thought she was sleeping or just knocked senseless by the force of the collision with the wall. But then he noticed the blood around her mouth and the blood that had run from her ears. He remembered how his own ears and lungs had almost burst from the concussion of the bombs, and he knew what had happened to his mother. He shook her. Mother! Mother! He continued to shake her. Mother! Farida Khalil opened her eyes and tried to focus on her oldest son. She began to speak, but coughed up foamy blood. Mother! It is Assad! She gave a slight nod. Mother, I am going to get help. She grabbed his arm with surprising strength and shook her head. She pulled on his arm, and he understood that she wanted him closer. Assad Khalil bent over so that his face was only inches from that of his mother. She tried to speak again, but coughed up more blood, which Khalil could now smell. She kept her grip on him, and he said, Mother, you will be all right. I will go for a doctor. No. He was surprised to hear her voice, which sounded nothing like his mother's voice. He worried that there was damage done inside of her and that she was bleeding internally. He thought he might be able to save her if he could get her to the compound hospital. But she would not let him go. She knew she was dying and she wanted him close when she took her last breath. She whispered in his ear, Kadir, Issam, Lena. Adara? Yes, they are all right. They are... They... will be... He found himself weeping so hard he couldn't continue. Faraday whispered, "My poor children. My poor family." Khalil let out a long wailing sound, then screamed out, "Allah, why have you deserted us?" Khalil wept on his mother's breast, felt her heartbeat beneath his cheek, and heard her whisper, "My poor family." Then her heart stopped, and Asad Khalil remained very still, listening for it, waiting for her chest to rise and fall again. He waited. He lay on her breasts a long time, then he stood and walked out of her room. He wandered in a trance through the rubble of his home and found himself outside in front of the house. He stood looking at the scene of chaos around him. Someone yelled nearby, "The whole Atiyah family is dead!" Men cursed, women wept, children screamed, ambulances came, stretchers took people away. A truck passed by, loaded with white, shrouded bodies. He heard a man say that the great leader's house nearby had been hit by a bomb. The great leader had escaped, but members of his family had been killed. Asad Khalil stood and listened to all that was said around him and noticed some of what was happening, but everything seemed very far away. He began walking aimlessly and was almost hit by a speeding fire truck. He kept walking and found himself back near the munitions building where Bahira lay dead on the roof. He wondered if her family had survived. In any case, whoever was looking for her would be looking through the rubble in the area of the living quarters. It would be days or weeks before she was found on the roof, and by then the body would be... It would be assumed she died of concussion. Asad Khalil found, to his astonishment, that he was still thinking clearly about certain things despite his grief. He moved quickly away from the munitions building, not wanting any further association with that place. He walked, alone with his thoughts, alone in the world. He said to himself, "My whole family are martyrs for Islam. I have succumbed to a temptation outside the Sharia, and because of that, I was not in my bed, and I have been spared the fate of my family. But Bahira succumbed to the same temptation and has suffered a different fate." He tried to make sense of all this and asked Allah to help him understand the meaning of this night. The gobli whistled through the camp, blowing up dust and sand. The night was colder now, and the moon had set, leaving the blacked-out camp in total darkness. He had never felt so alone. So frightened, so helpless. "Allah, please, make me understand." He lay face down on the black road facing toward Mecca. He prayed. He asked for an omen. He asked for guidance. He tried to think clearly. He had no doubt who it was that had brought such destruction on them. There had been rumors for months that the madman, Reagan, would attack them, and now it had happened. He had an image of his mother speaking to him. "My poor family must be avenged." Yes, that's what she had said, or was about to say. Suddenly, in a flash of understanding, it became clear to him that he had been chosen to avenge not only his family, but his nation, his religion, and the great leader. He would be Allah's instrument for revenge. He, Asad Khalil, had nothing left to lose and nothing left to live for unless he took up the jihad and carried the holy war to the shores of the enemy. Asad Khalil's 16-year-old mind was now set and focused on simple revenge and retribution. He would go to America and slice the throats of everyone who had taken part in this cowardly attack. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. This was the Arab death feud, the blood feud, more ancient even than the Quran or jihad, as ancient as the gobli. He said aloud, "I swear to Allah that I will avenge this night." Lieutenant Bill Satherwaite asked his weapons officer, "All bullseyes?" Yeah, Chip Wiggins replied. Well, one of them may have overshot. Wiggins added, hit something, though. A line of, like, smaller buildings. Good, as long as you didn't hit the Arch of Mario. Marcus. Whatever. You owe me dinner, Chip. No, you owe me dinner. You missed a bullseye. You buy. Okay, I'll buy if you fly back over the Arch of Marcus Aurelius. I flew in over the arch. You missed it. Satherwaite added, see it when you come back as a tourist. Chip Wiggins had no intention of ever coming back to Libya except in a fighter plane. They flew on over the desert, and suddenly the coast streaked by below, and they were over the Mediterranean. They didn't need radio silence any longer, and Satherwaite transmitted, feet wet. They headed for the rendezvous point with the rest of their squadron. Wiggins remarked, we won't hear from Momar for a while. He added, maybe not ever again. Satherwaite shrugged. He was not unaware that these surgical strikes had a purpose beyond testing his flying ability. He understood that there would be political and diplomatic problems after this, but he was more interested in the locker room chatter back at Lackenheath. He looked forward to the debriefings. He thought fleetingly about the 4 2,000-pound laser-guided bombs they had let loose, and he hoped everyone down there had enough warning to get into their shelters. He really didn't want to hurt anyone. Wiggins broke into his thoughts and said, by dawn, Radio Libya will report that we hit 6 hospitals, 7 orphanages, and 10 mosques. Satherwaite didn't respond. 2,000 civilians dead, all women and children. How's the fuel?
About 2 hours.
Good. Did you have fun?
Yeah, until the AAA.
Satherwaite replied, you didn't want to bomb a defenseless target, did you? Wiggins laughed, then said, hey, we're combat veterans. That we are. Wiggins stayed silent a while, then asked, I wonder if they're going to retaliate. He added, I mean, they screw us, we screw them, they screw us, we screw them. Where does it end?
Book 3. America, April 15th, the present. Terrible he rode alone with his Yemen sword for aid. Ornament it carried none but the notches on the blade. The Death Feud, an Arab war song. Chapter 18. Assad Khalil recently arrived by air from Paris, and the only survivor of Transcontinental Flight 175 sat comfortably in the back of a New York City taxicab. He stared out the right side window, noticing the tall buildings set back from the highway. He noticed, too, that many of the cars here in America were bigger than in Europe or in Libya. The weather was pleasant, but, as in Europe, there was too much humidity for a man used to the arid climate of North Africa. Also, as in Europe, there was much green vegetation. The Quran promised a paradise of greenery, flowing streams, eternal shade, fruits, wine, and women. It was curious, he thought, that the lands of the infidels seemed to resemble paradise. But the resemblance, he knew, was only superficial. Or perhaps Europe and America was the paradise promised in the Quran, awaiting only the coming of Islam. Assad Khalil turned his attention to the taxi driver, Gamal Jabbar, his compatriot, whose photo and name were prominently displayed on a license mounted on the dashboard. Libyan intelligence in Tripoli had asked Khalil that his driver would be 1 of 5 men. There were many Muslim taxi drivers in New York City, and many of them could be persuaded to do a small favor, even though they were not chosen freedom fighters. Khalil's case officer in Tripoli, who he knew as Malik, the king or the master, had said with a smile, many drivers have relatives in Libya. Khalil asked Gamal Jabbar, what is this road? Jabbar replied in Libyan-accented Arabic, this is called the Belt Parkway. You see, the Atlantic Ocean is over there. This part of the city is known as Brooklyn. Many of our co-religionists live here. I know that. Why are you here? Jabbar did not like the tone or the implication of the question, but he had a prepared answer and replied,
just to make money in this accursed land. I will return to Libya and my family in 6 months.
Khalil knew this wasn't true. Not because he thought Jabbar was lying, but because Jabbar would be dead within the hour.
Khalil looked out the window at the ocean on his left, then at the tall apartment buildings on his right, and then toward the distant skyline of Manhattan to his front. He had spent enough time in Europe not to be overly impressed with what he saw here. The lands of the infidels were populous and prosperous, but the people had turned away from their god and were weak. People who believed in nothing but filling their bellies and their wallets were no match for the Islamic fighters.
Khalil said to Jabbar, "Do you adhere to your faith here, Jabbar?"
"Yes, of course. There is a mosque near my home. I have maintained my faith."
"Good.
And for what you are doing today, you are assured a place in paradise."
Jabbar did not reply. Khalil sat back in his seat and reflected on the last hour of this important day. Getting out of the airport service area and into this taxi and on to this highway had been very simple, but Khalil knew that it might not have been so easy 10 or 15 minutes later. He had been surprised on board the aircraft when he heard the tall man in the suit say, "Crime scene," and then the man looked at him and ordered him off the spiral staircase. Khalil wondered how the police knew so soon that a crime had been committed. Perhaps he thought the fireman on board had said something on his radio. But Khalil and Youssef Haddad, his accomplice, had been careful not to leave any obvious evidence of a crime. In fact, Khalil thought, he had gone through the difficulty of breaking Haddad's neck so as not to leave evidence of a gunshot or knife wound. There were other possibilities, Khalil thought. Perhaps the fireman had noticed the missing thumbs of the federal agents. Or perhaps because the fireman was out of radio contact for a short time, the police became suspicious. Khalil had not planned to kill the fireman, but he had no choice when the man tried to open the lavatory door. His only regret in killing the fireman was that another piece of evidence had been created at a critical moment in his plans. In any case, the situation had changed quickly when that man in the suit came aboard, and Khalil then had to move more quickly. He smiled at the thought of that man telling him to get down from the staircase, which was exactly what he had been doing anyway. Getting off the aircraft had been not only simple, he'd actually been ordered to leave. Getting into the baggage truck, whose engine was running, and driving off in the confusion had been even less of a problem. In fact, he'd had dozens of unoccupied vehicles to choose from, which is what he'd been told by Libyan intelligence, who had a friend working as a baggage handler for Transcontinental Airlines. Khalil's map of the airport had come from a website source, and the location of the place called the Conquistador Club had been accurately identified by Boutros, the man who had preceded him in February. Libyan intelligence had made Khalil rehearse the route from the security area to the Conquistador Club, and Khalil could have made the drive blindfolded after 100 rehearsals on mock roads laid out near Tripoli. He thought about Boutros, whom he had met only once. Not about the man himself, but about how easily Boutros had deceived the Americans in Paris, in New York, and then in Washington. The American intelligence people were not stupid, but they were arrogant, and arrogance led to overconfidence and thus carelessness. Khalil said to Jabbar, "You are aware of the significance of this day."
"Of course. I am from Tripoli. I was a boy when the American bombers came. A curse be unto them."
"Did you suffer personally in the attack?"
"I lost an uncle at Benghazi, my father's brother. His death saddens me even now."
Khalil was amazed at how many Libyans had lost friends and relatives in the bombing that had killed fewer than 100 people. Khalil had long ago assumed they were all lying. Now he was probably in the presence of another liar. Khalil did not often speak of his own suffering from that air attack, and he would never reveal such a thing outside Libya. But since Jabbar would soon pose no security risk, Khalil said to him, "My entire family was killed at Al-Aziziyah." Jabbar sat in silence a moment, then said, "My friend, I weep for you. My mother, my two sisters, my two brothers." Again silence. Then Jabbar said,
Yes, yes, I recall. The family of...
Khalil.
Yes, yes, they were all martyred at Al-Aziziyah.
Jabbar turned his head to look at his non-paying passenger.
Sir, may Allah avenge your suffering. May God give you peace and strength until you see your family again in paradise.
Jabbar went on, heaping praise, blessings, and sympathy on Asad Khalil. Khalil's mind returned to earlier in the day, and again he thought of the tall man in the suit and the woman in the blue jacket who seemed to be his accomplice. The Americans, like the Europeans, made women into men, and the men became more like women. This was an insult to God and to God's creation. Woman was made of the rib of Adam to be his helpmate, not to be his equal. In any case, when that man and woman came on board, the situation had changed quickly. In fact, he had considered avoiding the place called the Conquistador Club, the secret headquarters of the federal agents, but it was a target that he could not resist, a treat he had savored in his mind since February when Boutros had reported its existence to Malik. Malik had said to Khalil, This is a tempting dish offered to you on your arrival, but it will not be as filling to you as those dishes served cold. Make your decision carefully and wisely. Kill only what you can eat, or what you can hide for later. Khalil remembered those words, but had decided to take the risk and kill those who believed they were his jailers. Khalil considered that what had happened on the aircraft was of little consequence. Poison gas was an almost cowardly way to kill, but it had been part of the plan. The bombs that Khalil had detonated in Europe gave him little satisfaction, though he appreciated the symbolism of killing those people in a manner similar to the way his family had been killed by the cowardly American pilots. The killing of the American Air Force officer in England with the axe had given him the greatest satisfaction. He still recalled the man walking to his car in the dark parking lot, aware that someone was behind him. He remembered the officer turning to him and saying, Can I help you? Khalil smiled. Yes, you can help me, Colonel Hambrecht. Then Khalil had said to the man, Al-Aziziyah. And he would never forget the expression on the man's face before Khalil swung the axe from under his trench coat and hit the man with the blade, almost severing his arm. And then Khalil took his time, chopping at the man's limbs, ribs, genitals, holding off the fatal blow to his heart until he was sure the man had suffered enough pain to be in extreme agony, but not so much pain as to become unconscious. Then he delivered the axe blow to the sternum, which split it open as the blade cut into his heart. The American colonel still had enough blood in him to produce a small geyser, which Khalil hoped the man could see and feel before he died. Khalil had been sure to remove Colonel Hambrecht's wallet and watch to make it look like a robbery, though the axe murder clearly did not look like part of a simple robbery. Still, it put questions in the minds of the police, who had to label the murder as a possible robbery, but possibly political. Khalil's next thought was of the three American schoolchildren in Brussels, waiting for a bus. There were supposed to be four, one for each of his sisters and brothers, but there were only three that morning. A female adult was with them, probably the mother of one or two. Khalil had stopped his car, got out, and shot each child in the chest and head, smiled at the woman, got back in the car, and drove off. Malik had been angry with him for leaving a witness alive who saw his face, but Khalil had no doubt that the woman would remember nothing for the rest of her life except the three children dying in her arms. This was how he had avenged the death of his mother. Khalil thought a moment about Malik, his mentor, his master, almost his father. Malik's own father, Numair, the panther, was a hero in the War of Independence against the Italians. Numair had been captured by the Italian army and hanged when Malik was just a boy. Malik and Khalil shared and were bonded by the loss of their fathers to the infidels, and both had sworn revenge. Malik, whose real name was unknown, had, after his father had been hanged, offered to spy for the British against the Italians and the Germans as the armies of the three countries killed one another across the length of Libya. Malik had also spied for the Germans against the British, and his combined spying on the armies of both sides had ensured greater slaughter. When the Americans arrived, Malik found yet another employer who trusted him. Khalil recalled that Malik once told him of the time he led an American patrol into a German ambush, then returned to the American lines and revealed to them the location of the German ambush party. Khalil had been in awe of Malik's duplicity and of his death toll without firing a shot himself. Asad Khalil had been trained in the killing arts by many good men, but it had been Malik who taught him how to think, to act, to deceive, to understand the mind of the Westerner, and to use that knowledge to avenge all those who believed in Allah and who had been killed over the centuries by the Christian infidels. Malik had told Asad Khalil, "You have the strength and courage of a lion. You have been taught to kill with the speed and ferocity of a lion. I will teach you to be as cunning as a lion. For without cunning, Asad, you will be an early martyr." Malik was old now, nearly 70 years on this earth, but he had lived long enough to see many triumphs of Islam over the West. He had told Khalil on the day before Khalil went to Paris, "God willing, you will reach America, and the enemies of Islam and of our great leader will fall before you. God has ordained your mission, and God will keep you safe until you return. But you must help God a bit by remembering all you have been taught and all you have learned. God himself has put in your hand the names of our enemies, and he has done so that you may slay them all. Be driven by revenge, but do not be blinded by hate. The lion does not hate. The lion kills all who threaten him or have tormented him. The lion also kills when he is hungry. Your soul has been hungry since that night when your family was taken from you. Your mother's blood calls to you, Asad. The innocent blood of Issam, Kadir, Adara, and Lena calls out to you. And your father, Karim, who was my friend, will be watching you from heaven. Go, my son, and return in glory. I will be waiting for you." Khalil almost felt tears forming in his eyes as he thought of Malik's words. He sat quietly for a while as the taxi moved through traffic, thinking, praying, thanking God for his good fortune so far. He had no doubt that he was at the beginning of the end of his long journey that had begun on the rooftop of Al-Aziziyah so long ago, on this very date. The thought of the rooftop brought back an unpleasant memory, the memory of Bahira, and he tried to put this out of his mind, but her face kept returning to him. They had found her body 2 weeks later, so badly decomposed that no one knew how she died, and no one could guess why she had been on that roof so far from her house in Al-Aziziyah. Asad Khalil, in his naivete, imagined that the authorities would connect him to Bahira's death, and he lived in mortal fear of being accused of fornication, blasphemy, and murder. But those around him mistook his agitated state for grief over the loss of his family. He was grief-stricken, but he was perhaps slightly more frightened of having his head severed from his body. He did not fear death itself, he told himself over and over again. What he feared was a shameful death, an early death that would keep him from his mission of revenge. They did not come for him to kill him. They came to him with pity and respect. The great leader himself had attended the funeral of the Khalil family, and Asad had attended the funeral of Hana, the Qaddafi's 18-month-old adopted daughter who had been killed in the air raid. Khalil had also visited the hospital to see the great leader's wife, Safiya, who had been wounded in the attack, as well as two of the Qaddafi sons, all of whom recovered. Praise be to Allah. And 2 weeks later, Asad had attended the funeral of Bahira. But after so many funerals, he felt numb, without grief or guilt. A doctor had explained that Bahira Nadir could have been killed by concussion or simply by fright, and she was thus joined with the other martyrs in paradise. Asad Khalil saw no reason to confess to anything that would shame her memory or her family. Regarding the Nadirs, the fact that the rest of the family had survived the bombing had caused Khalil to feel something like anger toward them. Envy, perhaps. But at least with Bahira's death, they could feel part of what he felt from losing everyone he loved. In fact, the Nadir family had been very good to him after the shared tragedy, and he'd lived with them for a while. It was during this time with the Nadirs, as he shared their home and their food, that he'd learned how to overpower his guilt at having killed and shamed their daughter. What happened on the roof was Bahira's fault alone. She had been fortunate to be honored as a martyr after her shameless and immodest behavior. Khalil looked out the window and saw a huge gray bridge in front of him. He asked Jabbar, "What is that?" Jabbar replied, "That is called the Verrazano Bridge. It will take us to Staten Island. Then we cross another bridge to New Jersey." Jabbar added, "There is much water here and many bridges." He had driven a few of his countrymen over the years, some immigrants, some businessmen, some tourists, some on other business like this man, Asad Khalil, in the rear of his taxi. Nearly all of the Libyans he'd driven were amazed at the tall buildings, the bridges, the highways, and the green expanses. But this man didn't seem amazed or impressed, just curious. He said to Khalil, "Is this your first time in America?" "Yes, and my last." They drove over the long bridge, and at the crown of the bridge, Jabbar said, "If you look that way, sir, to your right you will see Lower Manhattan, what they call the financial district. You will notice the two very tall and identical towers." Khalil looked at the massive buildings of Lower Manhattan, which seemed to rise out of the water. He saw the two towers of the World Trade Center and appreciated Jabbar pointing them out. Khalil said, "Maybe next time." Jabbar smiled and replied, "God willing." In truth, Gamal Jabbar thought the bombing of the one tower was a horrible thing, but he knew what to say and who to say it to. In truth, too, the man in the back made him uneasy, though he couldn't say why. Maybe it was the man's eyes. They moved around too much, and the man spoke only occasionally, then lapsed into silence. With almost any Arabic speaker, the conversation in the taxi would have been ceaseless and good-hearted. With this man, conversation was difficult. Christians and Jews spoke more to him than this compatriot. Jabbar slowed his vehicle as he approached the toll booths on the Staten Island side of the bridge. Jabbar said quickly to Khalil, "This is not a police or customs checkpoint. I have to pay here for the use of the bridge." Khalil laughed and replied, "I know that. I have spent time in Europe. Do you think I'm an illiterate desert tribesman?" "No, sir, but sometimes our countrymen get nervous." "Your bad driving is the only thing that makes me nervous." They both laughed. Jabbar said to his passenger, "I have an electronic pass that will permit me to go through the toll booth without having to stop and pay an attendant, but if you wish to have no record of this crossing, then I must stop and pay cash." Khalil wanted neither a record of the crossing nor did he want to approach a booth with a person in it. The record he knew would be permanent and might be used to trace his route to New Jersey, because when they found Jabbar dead in his taxi, they might connect him to Asad Khalil. Khalil said to Jabbar, "Pay in cash." Khalil put an English-language newspaper in front of his face as Jabbar slowed down and approached the toll booth at the shortest line. Jabbar pulled up to the booth, paid the toll in cash without exchanging a word with the toll attendant, then accelerated onto a wide highway. Khalil lowered the newspaper. They were not yet looking for him, or, if they were, they had not yet put out an alert this far from the airport. He wondered if they had concluded that the dead body of Yusef Haddad was not the dead body of Asad Khalil. Haddad had been chosen as an accomplice because he bore a slight resemblance to Khalil, and Khalil also wondered if Haddad had guessed his fate. The sun was low on the horizon now, and within 2 hours it would be dark. Khalil preferred the darkness for the next part of his journey. He had been told that the American police were numerous and well-equipped, and that they would have his photo and description within half an hour of his leaving the airport. But he had also been told that the automobile was his best means of escape. There were too many of them to stop and search, which was not the case in Libya. Khalil would avoid what were called choke points. Airports, bus stations, train stations, hotels, houses of his compatriots, and certain roads, bridges, and tunnels where the toll takers or police might have his photo. This bridge was one such place, but he was certain that the speed of his escape had gotten him through the net that was not yet fully in place. And if they made the net tighter around New York City, it didn't matter because he was nearly out of the area and would never return to this place. And if they made the net larger, which they would, then the net would be looser, and he could easily slip through it at any point in his journey. Many police, yes, but many people, too. Malik had told him, 20 years ago, an Arab might have been noticed in an American city, but today you might not even be noticed in a small town. The only thing an American man notices is a beautiful woman. They had both laughed at that. Malik had added, and the only things an American woman notices is how other women dress and the clothes in shop windows. They exited the highway onto another highway heading south. The taxi maintained a safe speed, and soon Khalil saw another bridge rising to his front. Jabbar said, "There is no toll from this direction on this bridge. On the other side of the bridge is the state of New Jersey." Khalil didn't reply. His thoughts went back to his escape. Speed, they had told him at his intelligence briefing in Tripoli. Speed. Fugitives tend to move slowly and carefully, and that's how they get caught. Speed, simplicity, and boldness. Get in the taxi and keep going. No one will stop you as long as the taxi driver does not go too fast or too slow. Make the driver assure you that there are no problems with his brake lights or signal lights. The American police will stop you for that. Sit in the rear of the taxi. There will be an English language newspaper there. All our drivers are familiar with American driving and laws. They are all licensed taxi drivers. Malik had further instructed him, if you are stopped by the police for any reason, assume it has nothing to do with you. Sit in the taxi. Let the driver talk. Most American policemen travel alone. If the policeman speaks to you, answer in English with respect, but not fear. The policeman may not search you, or the driver, or the vehicle, without a legal reason. This is the law in America. Even if he searches the taxi, he will not search you unless he is certain you are someone he is seeking. If he asks you to get out of the taxi, he intends to search you. Leave the taxi, draw your pistol, and shoot him. He will not have his gun drawn unless he is already certain you are Assad Khalil. If that is the case, may Allah protect you. And be certain to have your bulletproof vest on. They will give this to you in Paris to protect you from assassins. Use it against them. Use the federal agents' guns against them. Khalil nodded to himself. They were very thorough in Libya. The great leader's intelligence organization was small, but well-financed and well-trained by the old KGB. The godless Russians had been knowledgeable, but they had faith in nothing, which was why their state had collapsed so suddenly and so totally. The great leader still made use of the former KGB men, hiring them like whores to service the Islamic fighters. Khalil himself had been trained partly by Russians, some Bulgarians, and even some Afghani, who the American CIA had trained to fight the Russians. It was like the war which Malik had fought between the Germans and Italians on one side and the British and the Americans on the other. The infidels fought and killed one another and trained Islamic fighters to help them, not understanding that they were sowing the seeds of their further destruction. Jabbar crossed the bridge and turned the taxi off the highway onto a street of houses that looked, even to Khalil, like poor homes. What is this place? It is called Perth Amboy. How much longer? 10 minutes, sir. And there is no problem with this automobile being noticed in this other state? No. One may drive freely from state to state. Only if I go too far from New York might someone notice a taxi so far from the city. To journey a long distance by taxi can be expensive. Jabbar added, but of course you should pay no attention to this taxi meter. I leave it on because it is the law.
There are many small laws here.
Yes, you must obey the small laws so you can more easily break the big ones.
They both laughed. Khalil pulled out the wallet in the breast pocket of the dark gray suit jacket that Gamal Jabbar had given him. He checked his passport, which had his photo showing him wearing glasses and a short mustache. It was a clever photo, but he was concerned about the mustache. In Tripoli, where they had taken the photo, they told him, "Yusef Haddad will give you a false mustache and eyeglasses. It is necessary as a disguise, but if the police search you, they will test your mustache, and when they see that the mustache is false, they will know that everything else is false."
Khalil put his fingers to the mustache, then tugged on it. It was firmly fixed, but yes, it could be discovered to be false. In any event, he had no intention of letting a policeman get close enough to pull on his mustache. He had the glasses given to him by Haddad in his breast pocket. He didn't need glasses, but these were bifocals so that he could see with them on, and they would also pass as legitimate reading glasses. He looked at the passport again. His name was Hefni Badir, and he was an Egyptian, which was good, because if he were questioned by an Arab-American who worked for the police, a Libyan could pass for an Egyptian. Khalil had spent many months in Egypt and felt confident that he could convince even an Egyptian-American that they were countrymen. The passport also gave his religion as Muslim, his occupation as schoolteacher, which he could easily impersonate, and his residence as El Minya, a city on the Nile that few Westerners or even Egyptians were familiar with. But this was a place where he'd spent a month for the explicit purpose of reinforcing what was called his legend, his false life. Khalil checked through the wallet and found $500 in American money, not too much to draw attention, but enough to meet his needs. He also found some Egyptian money, an Egyptian internal identification card, an Egyptian bank card in his assumed name, and an American Express card, also in his assumed name, that Libyan intelligence told him would work in any American scanner. Also in his breast pocket was an international driver's license in the name of Hefni Badir, with a photo similar to the one on his passport. Jabbar was glancing in his rearview mirror and said to him, "Is everything in order, sir?"
Khalil replied, "I hope I never have to discover if it is."
Again, they both laughed.
Khalil put everything back in his breast pocket. If he were stopped at this time, he could probably deceive an ordinary policeman. But why should he bother to be an actor just because he wore a disguise? Despite what they'd told him in Libya, his first reaction, not his last, would be to pull both his pistols and kill anyone who posed a threat to him.
Khalil opened the black overnight bag that Jabbar had placed for him in the back seat. He rummaged through the big bag, finding toilet articles, underwear, a few ties, a sports shirt, a pen and a blank notebook, American coins, a cheap camera of the type a tourist might have, two plastic bottles of mineral water, and a small copy of the Quran, printed in Cairo. There was nothing in the bag that could compromise him. No invisible writing, no microdots, not even a new pistol. Everything he needed to know was in his head. Everything he needed to use would be provided or acquired along the way. The only thing that could connect him, Hefni Badir, to Assad Khalil were the two federal agents' Glock pistols. In Tripoli, they had told him to dispose of the pistols as soon as possible, and his taxi driver would give him a new pistol. But he had replied, "If I'm stopped, what difference does it make what pistol I have with me? I wish to use the enemy's weapons until I complete my mission or until I die." They did not argue with him, and there was no pistol in the black bag. There were two items in the bag that could possibly compromise him. The first was a tube of toothpaste that was actually gum for his false mustache. The second was a can of foot powder, an Egyptian brand that was, in fact, colored with a gray tint. Khalil twisted the cap and sprinkled the powder in his hair, then combed it through as he looked at himself in a small hand mirror. The results were amazing, turning his jet-black hair to a salt and pepper gray. He restyled his swept-back hair into a part on the left side, put on his glasses, then said to Jabbar, "Well, what do you think?" Jabbar glanced in his rearview mirror and said, "What has become of the passenger I picked up at the airport? What have you done with him, Mr. Badir?"
They both laughed, but then Jabbar realized he should not have drawn attention to the fact that he knew the fictitious name of his passenger,
and he fell silent. Jabbar looked in his rearview mirror and saw this man's dark eyes staring at him. Khalil turned to look out the window. They were still in an area that seemed less prosperous than any he had seen in Europe, but there were many good cars parked on the streets, which surprised him. Jabbar said, "Look there, sir. That is the highway you will need to drive on. It is called the New Jersey Turnpike. That is the entrance to the highway there. You will take a ticket from a machine and pay a toll when you get off. The highway goes north and south, so you must get into the proper lane." Khalil noted that Jabbar did not ask him which way he was going to travel. Jabbar understood that the less he knew, the better for everyone. But Jabbar already knew too much. Khalil asked Jabbar, "Do you know what happened at the airport today?"
"Which airport, sir?"
"The one we came from."
"No, I do not."
"Well, you will hear about it on the radio." Jabbar did not reply. Khalil opened one of the bottles of mineral water, drank half of it, then tipped the bottle and poured the remainder on the floor. They pulled into a huge parking lot with a sign that said, "Park and Ride." Jabbar explained, "People drive their cars here and take a bus into Manhattan, into the city. But today is Saturday, so there are not many cars." Khalil looked around at the expanses of crumbling blacktop surrounded by a chain-link fence. There were about 50 cars parked within white lines, but the parking lot could hold hundreds more. He noted, too, that there were no people in view. Jabbar put his taxi in a parking space and said, "There, sir, do you see that black car straight ahead?" Khalil followed Jabbar's gaze to a large black automobile parked a few rows ahead of them.
"Yes. Here are the keys."
Without looking at Khalil, Jabbar passed the keys over the seat. Jabbar said, "All of your rental papers are in the glove box. The car is rented in the name on your passport for 1 week, so after that time the car agency may become concerned. The car was rented at Newark Airport in New Jersey, but the license plates are from New York. This is of no concern." "That is all I have been instructed to tell you, sir. But if you would like, I can lead you back to the highway."
"That won't be necessary."
"May Allah bless your visit, sir. May you return safely to our homeland." Khalil already had the .40 caliber Glock in his hand. He put the muzzle of the Glock into the opening of the empty plastic bottle and pushed the bottom of the bottle against the rear of the driver's seat. He fired a shot through the back of the seat into Gamal Jabbar's upper spine, so that if it missed the spinal column, it would penetrate the heart from the rear. The plastic bottle muffled the blast of the gun. Jabbar's body lurched forward, but his harness belt held him upright. Smoke poured from the bottle's neck and from the bullet hole in the bottom. Khalil loved the smell of burnt cordite and inhaled it through his nostrils. He said, "Thank you for the water." Khalil considered a second shot, but then he saw Jabbar's body start to twitch in a way that a man could not fake. Khalil waited half a minute, listening to Jabbar's gurgling. As he waited for Jabbar to die, he found the empty .40 caliber shell casing and put it in his pocket, then put the plastic bottle in his overnight bag. Gamal Jabbar finally stopped twitching, gurgling, and breathing, and sat motionless. Khalil looked around to be certain they were alone in the lot, then he reached over the seat and quickly took Jabbar's wallet from his pocket, then unfastened the man's seatbelt and pushed him down below the dashboard. He turned off the ignition and took the keys out. Asad Khalil removed his black overnight bag, got out of the taxi, closed and locked the doors, then walked to the black car, which was called a Mercury Marquis. The key fit, he entered the car and started it, remembering his seatbelt. He moved out of the quiet parking lot onto the street. He recalled a line from the Hebrew scripture, "A lion is in the streets." He smiled. Chapter 19. An FBI guy named Hal Roberts met Kate, Ted, and me in the lobby of 26 Federal Plaza. When someone meets you in the lobby of your workplace, it's either an honor or you're in trouble. Mr. Roberts was not smiling, and this was my first clue that we were not going to receive letters of commendation. We got on the elevator, and Roberts used his key for the 28th floor. We rode up in silence. 26 Federal Plaza is home to various government agencies, most of them no more than innocuous tax eaters.
But floors 22 through 28 are not innocuous and are accessible only by key. I was given a key when I started this job, and the guy who gave it to me said, I'd like to get the thumbprint pad here. You can forget your key or lose it, but you can't forget to lose your thumb. Actually, you can lose your thumb. My work floor was 26, where I had a piece of a cube farm along with other ex-NYPD and active duty NYPD. Also on the 26th floor were a few suits, as cops referred to the FBI. This is a bit of a misnomer, since many of the NYPD types wear suits, and about a third of the FBI types are female and don't wear suits. But I learned long ago never to question the jargon of an organization. Somewhere in the jargon is a clue to the mindsets of the people who work there. Anyway, we got to the top floor where the celestial beings dwelt, and we were ushered into a corner office facing southeast. The name on the door said Jack Koenig, known by his translated and transposed name as King Jack. Mr. Koenig's actual title was Special Agent in Charge, SAC for short, and he was in charge of the entire anti-terrorist task force. His dominion extended throughout the five boroughs of New York City, the surrounding counties of New Jersey and Connecticut, as well as nearby upstate New York and the two counties of Long Island, Nassau and Suffolk. It was in this latter county, on the east end of Long Island, where I had first run into Sir Ted and Sir George, to continue the metaphor, knights errant who turned out to be fools. In any case, I had no doubt that King Jack did not like things going wrong in his kingdom. His Highness had a big office with a big desk. There was also a couch and three club chairs around a coffee table. There were built-in bookshelves and an Arthurian round table and chairs, but no throne. His Majesty was not in, and Mr. Roberts said, "Make yourselves at home, put your feet up on the coffee table, and lay on the couch if you like." Actually, Mr. Roberts did not say this. Mr. Roberts said, "Wait here," and left. I wondered if I had time to get to my desk and check my hiring contract. I should mention that since this is a joint anti-terrorist task force, there is a New York City police captain who shares this command with Jack Koenig. The captain is named David Stein, a Jewish gent with a law degree, and in the eyes of the police commissioner, a man with enough brains to hold his own against the overeducated feds. Captain Stein has a tough job, but he's slick, sharp, and just diplomatic enough to keep the feds happy while still protecting the interests of the NYPD men and women under him. People like me, who are ex-NYPD contract agents, are in a sort of gray area, and no one looks out for our interests, but neither do I have the problems of career officers, so it's a wash. Anyway, regarding Captain Stein, he's a former intelligence unit guy who worked on a lot of cases involving Islamic extremists, including the murder of Rabbi Meir Kahan, and he's a natural for this job. Not to read too much into the Jewish thing, but he clearly has a personal problem with Islamic extremists. The anti-terrorist task force, of course, covers all terrorist organizations, but you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out where most of the focus was. In any case, I wondered if I'd be seeing Captain Stein tonight. I hoped so. We needed another cop in the room. Kate and Ted put Phil and Peter's briefcases on the round table without comment. I recalled occasions when I had to remove the shield, gun, and credentials of men I knew and return them to the precinct. It's not unlike when ancient warriors would take the swords and shields of their fallen comrades and bring them home. In this case, however, the weapons were missing. I opened the briefcases to be sure the cell phones were off. It's disturbing when a dead person's phone rings. Anyway, regarding Jack Koenig, I'd met him only once when I was hired, and I found him to be fairly intelligent, quiet, and thoughtful. He was known as a hard-ass and had a sarcastic side to him, which I admired greatly. I recalled that he'd said to me, apropos of my professorship at John Jay, "Those who can, do. Those who can't, teach." To which I'd replied, "Those who have taken three bullets on the job don't have to explain their second careers." After a moment of frosty silence, he smiled and said, "Welcome to the ATTF. Despite the smile and welcome, I had the impression he was a wee bit pissed at me. Maybe he'd forgotten the incident.
We stood in the office with a plush blue carpet, and I glanced at Kate, who seemed a little anxious. I looked at Ted Nash, who, of course, did not call Jack his special agent in charge. Mr. CIA had his own bosses, housed across the street at 290 Broadway, and I'd have given a month's pay to see him on the carpet at 290. But that would never happen. Some of the ATTF, by the way, is located at 290 Broadway, a newer and nicer building than Federal Plaza, and rumor has it that the separation of forces is not the result of an administrative space problem, but a planned strategy in the event someone decided to test out their advanced chemistry class on one of the federal buildings. Personally, I think it's just a planning screw-up and bureaucratic jockeying, but this kind of organization lends itself to top security explanations for common stupidity. If you're wondering why Ted, Kate, and John were not conversing, it's because we figured that the office was bugged. When two or more people are left alone in someone else's office, just assume you're on the air. Testing, 1, 2, 3. I did say, however, for the record, nice office. Mr. Koenig has really good taste. Ted and Kate ignored me. I glanced at my watch. It was nearly 7 p.m., and I suspected that Mr. Koenig was not happy about having to return to the office on a Saturday evening. I wasn't too thrilled with the idea either, but anti-terrorism is a full-time job. As we used to say in the Homicide Squad, when a murderer's day ends, our day begins. Anyway, I went to the window and looked out to the east. This part of Lower Manhattan is jam-packed with courthouses, and further to the east was One Police Plaza, my former headquarters where I'd had good visits and bad visits. Beyond Police Plaza was the Brooklyn Bridge from whence we'd come and which crossed over the East River itself, which separated Manhattan Island from Long Island. I could not actually see Kennedy Airport from here, but I could see the glow of its lights, and I noticed in the sky above the Atlantic Ocean what appeared to be a string of bright stars, like a new constellation, but which were actually approaching aircraft. Apparently, the runways were open again. Out in the harbor to the south was Ellis Island, through which millions of immigrants had passed, including my Irish ancestors. And to the south of Ellis Island, in the middle of the bay, stood the Statue of Liberty, all lit up, holding her torch high, welcoming the world. She was on just about every terrorist's hit list, but so far so good. She was still standing. All in all, it was a spectacular evening view from up here. The city, the lighted bridges, the river, the clear April sky, and a big half-moon rising in the east above the flatlands of Brooklyn. I turned and looked southwest through the big window of the corner office. The most dominant features out there were the twin towers of the World Trade Center, soaring a quarter mile into the sky, 110 stories of glass, concrete, and steel. The towers were about half a mile away, but they were so massive that they looked as if they were across the street. The towers were designated the North Tower and the South Tower, but on Friday, February 26, 1993, at 12:17 and 36 seconds p.m., the South Tower almost became known as the Missing Tower. Mr. Koenig's desk was arranged so that every time he looked out the window, he could see these towers, and he could contemplate what some Arab gentleman had prayed for when they had driven an explosive-filled van into the basement parking garage, namely, the collapse of the South Tower and the death of over 50,000 people in the tower and on the ground. And if the South Tower had collapsed just right and hit the North Tower, there would have been another 40 or 50,000 dead. As it turned out, the structure held and the death toll was 6, with over 1,000 injured. The subterranean explosion took out the police station located in the basement and left a cavern where the multi-layered underground parking garage had been. What could have been the biggest loss of American life since World War II turned out to be a loud and clear wake-up call. America had become the front lines. It occurred to me that Mr. Koenig could have rearranged his furniture or put blinds on the windows, but it said something about the man that he chose to look at these buildings every workday. I don't know if he cursed the security lapses that had led to the tragedy, or if he thanked God every morning that 100,000 lives had been spared. Probably he did both. And probably, too, these towers, plus the Statue of Liberty and Wall Street and everything else that Jack Koenig surveyed from up here, haunted his sleep every night.
King Jack had not actually been in charge of the ATTF when the bomb blew in 1993, but he was in charge now, and he might think about rearranging his desk Monday morning to look toward Kennedy Airport. Indeed, it was lonely at the top, but the view was supposed to be good. For Jack Koenig, however, there were no good views from here. The subject of my thoughts entered his office at that moment and caught me staring out at the World Trade Center. He asked me, "Are they still standing, Professor?" Apparently, he had a good memory for snotty subordinates. I replied, "Yes, sir." "Well, that's good news." He looked at Kate and Nash and motioned us all to the seating area. Kate and Nash sat on the couch, I sat in one of the three club chairs, while Mr. Koenig remained standing. Jack Koenig was a tall man of about 50 years old. He had short, steely gray hair, steely gray eyes, a steely gray Saturday stubble, a steely jaw, and stood like he had a steel rod up his ass that he was about to transfer to someone else's ass. All in all, he was not an avuncular type, and his mood looked understandably dark. Mr. Koenig was dressed in casual slacks, a blue sports shirt, and loafers, but on him nothing looked casual, sporty, or loafish. Hal Roberts entered the office and sat in the second club chair across from me. Jack Koenig didn't seem inclined to sit and relax. Mr. Roberts had a long yellow legal pad and a pencil. I thought perhaps he was going to take drink orders, but I was being too optimistic. Mr. Koenig began without preamble and asked us, "Can one of you explain to me how a cuffed and guarded suspected terrorist managed to kill 300 men, women, and children aboard an American airliner, including his two armed escorts and two federal air marshals on board, a Port Authority emergency serviceman, and then proceed to a secret and secure federal facility where he murdered an ATTF secretary, the FBI duty officer, and an NYPD member of your team?" He looked at each of us. "Would anyone care to take a shot at an explanation?" If I were at Police Plaza instead of Federal Plaza, I would have answered a sarcastic question like that by saying, "Can you imagine how much worse it could have been if the perp wasn't cuffed?" But this was not the time, place, or occasion for flippancy. A lot of innocent people were dead, and it was the job of the living to explain why. Nevertheless, King Jack was not getting off to a good start with his subjects. Needless to say, no one answered the question, which seemed to be rhetorical. It's a good idea to let the boss vent a while. To his credit, he vented only for another minute or so, then sat down and stared out of the window. His view was toward the financial district, so there were no unhappy associations attached to that scene, unless he happened to own Transcontinental stock. Jack Koenig, by the way, was FBI, and I'm sure that Ted Nash did not like being spoken to in such a manner by an FBI guy. I, as a quasi-civilian, didn't like it either, but Koenig was the boss, and we were all part of the task force. The team. Kate, being FBI, was in a career-threatening position, and so was George Foster. But George had chosen the easy job and stayed behind with the bodies. King Jack seemed to be trying to get himself under control. Finally, he looked at Ted Nash and said, "I'm sorry about Peter Gorman. Did you know him?" Nash nodded. Koenig looked at Kate and said, "You were a friend of Phil Hundry." "Yes." Koenig looked at me and said, "I'm sure you've lost friends on the job. You know how hard that is." "I do. Nick Monty had become my friend." Jack Koenig stared off into space again, contemplating many things, I'm sure. It was a time for respectful silence, and we gave it about a minute. But everyone knew that we had to get back to business quickly. I asked, perhaps undiplomatically, "Will Captain Stein be joining us?" Koenig looked at me a moment and finally said, "He's taken direct charge of the stakeout and surveillance teams and has no time for meetings." You never know what the bosses are actually up to or what kind of palace struggle is going on, and it's best not to give a shit. I yawned to indicate that I just lost interest in both my question and Koenig's answer. Koenig turned to Kate and said, "Okay, tell me what happened from the top." Kate seemed prepared for the question and went through the events of the day chronologically, objectively, and quickly, but without rushing. Koenig listened without interrupting. Roberts took notes,
Somewhere, an audio tape was spinning.
Kate mentioned my insistence on going out to the aircraft and the fact that neither she nor Foster thought it was necessary. Koenig's face remained impassive, neither approving nor disapproving throughout the narrative. He didn't raise an eyebrow, didn't frown, didn't wince, didn't nod or shake his head, and for sure never smiled. He was an expert listener, and nothing in his manner or demeanor encouraged or discouraged his witness. Kate got to the part where I went back into the dome of the 747 and discovered that Hundry's and Gorman's thumbs were missing. She stopped there and collected herself. Koenig glanced at me, and though he didn't give me any sign of approval, I knew that I was going to stay on the case. Kate moved on with the sequence of events, giving only the facts, leaving the speculation and theories for later, if and when Koenig asked for them. Kate Mayfield had an amazing memory for detail and an astonishing ability to refrain from coloring and slanting facts. I mean, in similar situations, when I was on the carpet in front of the bosses, I would try not to color or slant unless I was protecting a bud, but I have been known to have memory lapses. Kate concluded with, "George decided to stay and take charge of the scene. We all concurred, and we asked Officer Simpson to drive us here." I glanced at my watch. Kate's narrative had taken 40 minutes. It was now nearly 8 p.m., the time when my brain usually needs alcohol. Jack Koenig sat back in his chair, and I can see he was processing the facts. He said, "It seems as though Khalil was just a step or two ahead of us." I decided to reply and said, "That's all it takes in a race. Second place is just the first loser." Mr. Koenig regarded me a moment and repeated, "Second place is the first loser. Where did you get that?" "I think the Bible." Koenig said to Roberts, "Take a break," and Mr. Roberts put down his pencil. Koenig said to me, "I understand you've put in a transfer request for the IRA section." I cleared my throat and replied, "Well, I did, but do you have some personal grudge against the Irish Republican Army?" "No, actually, I..." Kate spoke up and said, "John and I discussed this earlier, and he has withdrawn the request." That's not exactly what I said to her, but it sounded better than my racist and sexist remarks regarding Muslims. I glanced at Kate, and our eyes met. Koenig informed me, "I reviewed the Plum Island case last fall." I didn't reply. I read the case report prepared by Ted Nash and George Foster and the report that was written by a Detective Beth Penrose of the Suffolk County Homicide Division. He added, "There seemed to be some differences of opinion and fact between the ATTF report and the Suffolk County Police report. Most of the differences had to do with your role in the case." I had no official role in the case. "Nevertheless, you solved the case." I had a lot of time on my hands. Maybe I need a hobby. He didn't smile. He said, "Detective Penrose's report was perhaps colored by your relationship with her." "I had no relationship with her at the time." "But you did when she wrote her final report." "Excuse me, Mr. Koenig, I've been through this with the NYPD Internal Affairs."
"Oh, they have people who investigate affairs?"
This, I realized, was a joke, and I chuckled, a second or two late. "Also," he continued, "Ted and George's report may have been colored by the fact that you pissed them off." I glanced at Nash, who seemed totally aloof, as usual, as though Koenig was talking about another Ted Nash. Koenig said, "I was fascinated by your ability to get to the heart of a very complex case that had eluded everyone else." "It was standard detective work," I said modestly, hoping that Mr. Koenig would say, "No, my boy, you're brilliant." But he didn't say that. He said, "That's why we hire NYPD detectives. They bring something different to the table." "Like donuts," I suggested. Mr. Koenig was neither amused nor annoyed. He said, "They bring to the table a degree of common sense, street smarts, and an insight into the criminal mind that is slightly different from that of an FBI or CIA agent. Do you agree?" "Absolutely." "It is an article of faith in the ATTF that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. Synergy."
right?
Right. This is only possible through mutual respect and cooperation. I was just about to say that.
He regarded me a moment and asked, Do you want to stay on this case?
Yes, I do.
He leaned toward me and looked in my eyes. He said, I don't want to see any grandstanding, I don't want to hear about any shitty attitudes, and I want complete loyalty from you, Mr. Corey, or so help me God, I'll have your head stuffed and mounted on my desk. Agreed?
My goodness. The guy sounded like my ex-bosses. There must be something about me that brings out the nasties in people.
Anyway, I mulled over the contract amendment. Could I be a loyal and cooperative team player?
No, but I wanted the job.
I realized that Mr. Koenig hadn't demanded that I cease my sarcasm or dull my rapier wit, and I took this as either approval or an oversight on his part.